So welcome, listeners, to a new episode of the CASE podcast, another conversation about software engineering. I'm extremely happy to have Christine Gorman as my guest today. Hi, Christine.
Hello. Nice to be here.
It's awesome to have you on the show. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Right. Well, my name is Christine Gorman. I am Norwegian, or I'm half American technically, I guess, but I'm a Norwegian developer. So I've been working, doing programming for 20 years now. I'm getting really old. I'm currently working as a contractor for a small company called Kodemaker. So we go out and help customers build software. So, but yeah, I'm hands-on writing software. That's all I've ever done really professionally.
Very cool. Okay, so when we decided about what to talk about in this episode, we spent some time with the title and then settled on why large projects fail and what to do about it. So maybe we can start by defining what kind of projects it is that we're talking about here. What kind of projects do you do, and why do you think some of them are good candidates for a conversation like this one?
Yes, well, I mean, I guess I can, touch on basically your last question. Why do I even care about this? And why is this something that I rant about at length? I started off, my first jobs was working for, you know, small companies and startups. And I was like the only developer or one of two. And we'd have a very natural kind of progression that we'd have to focus on what was most important to do and what our users needed. And we had to deliver or we'd go out of business, basically. So that was how I started working. And then I progressively started working for larger and larger companies. So I went from that into, and I worked for, I was in the oil industry to start with, and I worked for Schlumberger and Western GECO. So that's a much larger organization, but it's still a product development company. And then I went from there to my first public sector project in 2010. And I was, you know, after 10 years of working, you know, either as a startup trying to, you know, get things working, or in a product development organization trying to just, you know, working on problems, being met with the level of inefficiency that I was met with when I tried to do something in the public sector was just astounding to me. You know, I was surrounded by the most intelligent, wonderful people who were very technically competent and also just, you know, just nice people. I have nothing bad to say about the people in my team, but we were just unable to work effectively and to deliver what the customers actually needed. So that's kind of been the trigger for me, was to after, you know, 10 years of working more or less sensibly, I was always complaining, of course, you know, because that's kind of my nature. I'm always always want to do things better. But it was a real shock to just see, you know, how badly things can go. And it really opened my eyes to why I'd been hearing all these years that, oh, wow, you guys are working so fast and this is amazing. And I was like, well, this is normal, isn't it? You know, and so for me, it's, well, you know, what I've been ranting about is these large contracts that, you know, large organizations set out. They have this predefined, you know, requirement specification, like we're going to, you know, save the world. We're going to do this amazingly big project, and you put it out to tender. And then you have this, you know, enormous team of lots of people trying to solve kind of everything for this customer. So that's been primarily the kind of projects that I've been trying to argue against, or, you know, just to, you know, try to inform people of better ways of working. So, So, but, you know, like recently we have in the public sector in Norway, for instance, there's been lots of controversy recently about this healthcare platform project, you know, and there have been, I know there was one in the UK like 10 years ago or whatever, where they spent, you know, was it £10 billion or something? And for this huge healthcare platform that didn't even work, they had to do something else. You know, things like that.
We don't have those kinds of projects in Germany, right? In Germany, everything always runs on time and just, you know, on schedule. There's never anything never has anything like that happened around here. Okay. So I think this is going to be an interesting episode, because one of the things that I really enjoyed was that you complained very entertainingly when I saw you do a presentation on many of these topics. So I'm really interested in diving into more detail here. And I also share a bit of that history. I had the same feeling, like being surrounded, and that resonates with me very strongly. So being surrounded by awesome, super smart people who only want the best, right? They're all motivated. They all want to do good things, but they completely fail at doing it for some strange reason. So let's try to figure that out, and maybe try to define or to find a few ways out of that hole once if you find yourself in it. So let's talk about the projects. Why do they go wrong? I mean, what are some of the most common problems? I think you hinted at some, but maybe we can go into more detail about what that.
Well, I think one of the problems is that it's just our human lack of, we are very limited in what we are able to even conceive of in our small brains. There's a limited amount of complexity that we are capable of dealing with, and as Einstein said, you have to make things as simple as possible, but not simpler, and that is invariably what happens when we try to kind of bite off too much. When we try to solve too many problems or to take on too much, we have to simplify that to be able to kind of deal with what we're going to do. We have to simplify things too much. So then, necessary complexity has to be thrown out the window, and we end up with these, in computer terms, you have these systems where you have like tons of menu items and tons of input text boxes, that are only there because like someone else needs them, so you have this, but then text boxes you need for your job aren't even there because they've been simplified away. So, there's this, we need to just realize at the outset that we just cannot process, that much at a time. We have to break things down. So I think we're just too ambitious. We don't realize our own limitations. Especially when you're in charge of a large organization, you think, well, let's solve the organization as this one thing that we can, that is solvable, but it's just too much. So we need to realize that we just cannot do that. We have to break things into smaller pieces for it to, yeah.
So, but doesn't that sound, well, it seems like a kind of an obvious thing to say, right? I mean, I have this huge problem. So I subdivide it into more simpler problems so that I can solve each of them in turn. Why doesn't everybody see it that way? Why do people want to do those large things?
Yeah, I know that. To me, especially, when we're working with software, I think, we know how quickly complexity just runs completely out of hand, because we have to deal with the nitty gritty details. I think for developers, it should be a lot easier to realize the inherent necessity of breaking things into smaller components. But I think like for, when you're, lots of the people, or at least in my experience, the projects that go wrong have been decided upon by people who have no idea about this, and they work at a completely different abstraction level. So for them, it is just one problem. It is just, we need to handle health journal information. That is one thing to them. They don't see all the details and they don't have this inherent understanding of how extremely complex that necessarily becomes if you want to support every possible user group. So, people see things from their perspective. If you're the top manager for this company, you have a simplified view of all the things beneath you. And you're going to see that as, this is my company, and then you want a solution for your company, and you want something that's easy for you to understand. But very often, the problems arise, when the people who decide what to make are not the same people who are the ones who are going to use what's being made, that's where problems start. And the farther those two groups are away from each other, the more problems you end up with.
So I think the first thing you hinted at was reminds me of the saying that all things look very similar to each other from up here in the ivory tower, right? If you're far enough away from stuff, then it looks as if it's exactly the same thing. You have to get closer to find out, well, these things, I mean, they both look kind of similar, but they're really very, 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 very different. And if you try to solve them with the same solution, you're going to end up with lots of extra complexity. So the well-meaning idea of simplifying things or building them once instead of twice actually leads to something that is 10 times as large and doesn't solve the two problems as well as two separate solutions would have. That is, I think, a very common thing. So I completely agree on that. Is it also a matter of people's status or of manager's background? How much of a human thing is it to want those large things, those large projects?
Yeah, I'm sure there are all sorts of drivers. Of course, you know, if you're this project manager, there's far more prestige in having led this, you know, platform that revolutionized the healthcare industry or, you know, whatever. I mean, of course, there's far more prestige to be in charge of that rather than saying, you know what, I'm going to work on this, you know, this particular application that helps nurses with it in nursing homes. You know, that's not as prestigious. So there's definitely that. But also another, you know, huge problem is, you know, so much of, you know, people in management, you know, they, you know, have lots of, you know, there's the management schools and whatever, they have a, you know, proud history and a long history and lots of, you know, very good educational programs, I'm sure, that teach people to manage, you know, physical projects. So I think lots of project management ideology comes from managing construction of bridges, for instance, you know, and which is a completely different thing. You know, when you construct a bridge, you're building with physical things. You can't build a bridge halfway and then say, oh, well, you know what, it should have been, you know, 5 meters to the left. You know, that obviously doesn't work, right? You have to have these long planning phases where you just draw and you have nothing physical. And then when you're done with that, then you move on to the implementation phase, you know, and I think, you know, this causes so many problems when that is kind of when you try to do that within software and you have this idea that you can sit in meetings with the users and business people and write post-it notes and make, you know, all these requirement specifications, you ask the users what they need. And then you spend years and years doing all of that, building up this, now we're going to solve everything. And then you say, right, okay, here, technical people, implement this. You know, this is a recipe for disaster. So, and, you know, we can talk more about why that is. And I think we as software people know, how, you know, why that's a bad idea, but the fact that so many managers kind of have this old school mentality of you know, managing completely different things causes large problems, as well as the prestige element.
But I mean, isn't what you're saying just, well, we should all be doing agile software development and then our problems will be solved?
Yeah, well, in a way, I guess I am, you know, what I find immensely frustrating, you know, over these last 10 years, because it's been, you know, how long has it been since the Agile Manifesto came out? That's like 20 years. 20 years, right? Yeah.
And let me check.
You know, but Agile, the word Agile is just a joke now in Agile, you know, because, you know, it's been taken over by people who just, you know, use the word and they think using the word solves the problem, you know, and I've lost count of the amount of times that I've been, that I've said that we need to use, you know, we need to work in an agile manner. We need to kind of iterate and we need to, you know, get feedback from actual users to drive the process, you know, and then people say, yeah, but you can do that in the implementation phase. You know, and that's like, oh, for goodness sake, you know, so it's like everyone agrees that we have to be agile, but, you know, using that word doesn't really solve the problem. You have to understand what the word, you know, what the word was meant to be, you know, at the outset, at least, because, yes, I mean, we don't have the same limitations within software. That's, you know, both a blessing and a curse, I guess, is that we, you know, we can build the bridge. We can build this tiny little, string rope bridge. And then we can expand that over into a motorway as we go along. We can move where it goes. We don't have those same physical limitations that they do in these physical projects. So, just not taking advantage of that fact is nuts. You know, we can actually get started right away and actually, you know, build something quickly, test it, validate it. Do users actually need this? And if they do, we can build on it. We can change it. We don't need this like massive process where, you know, everything has to be decided upon up front. That's another driver that I just thought about for these this complexity. Is that so? Because users have gotten used to this thing that when they first get software, nothing changes for decades. You know, so they know that if they're going to get a new system, they'd better think of everything. You know, because they know that they're not going to get any updates after that. You know, so they're desperate to pour in every little bit of functionality that they can possibly think of. So the specification for what you have to build just grows and grows and grows. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how much of a problem do you think it is that it's often not the users, but rather somebody who represents or is supposed to represent the users? I think you mentioned this, you know, this distance between the people who have the responsibility for building the software and the ones who actually use it. Is that part of the problem as well?
Yeah, well, definitely part of the problem. And I think, so much of my time has been spent like, you know, can we actually speak to the users? So it's not the users, firstly, they are often separated in time from the development phase. So they are asked by business people like 5 years before the development even starts, you know, we really need to get, you know, that is, you know, so essential to just get more, you know, more direct, you know, that they can talk to the people in charge of actually building stuff while they are building it, you know, so you can get like the actual same functioning feedback loop.
Mm-hmm. So what has your experience been? Does it, if you get access to the users, do they actually work with the team or are they reluctant to do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another big problem, of course, is most users, they have a day-to-day job. You know, their job is to actually do the work that you are trying to kind of help them do better with new software. So that's a big problem is, of course, that they don't have, you know, they just they have time to set aside to give you the feedback that you need. And also most users, they are, you know, very often, you know, depending on what you're trying to make, but many users, of course, they are not very familiar with computer systems and they hate the idea of software changing all the time. They find that immensely frustrating, you know? So there's this conflict between, you know, if you ask the users what they want, they will say, just give me something that works, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, that makes a lot of sense. If I could telepathically understand what, you know, what the users would want and just, you know, understand fully what their day-to-day, you know, problems are, that would be the best thing to do. But the only way for me or, you know, a developer or whatever to really be able to understand what is actually needed, we have to have a running conversation and, you know, to try and fail a lot. You know, that's I feel like, you know, half the stuff you do ends up being, you know, based on a misunderstanding, you know, so, for users, that's very often you can't just ask the user what they want, because very often when you give it to them, they will then realize that, oh, well, that's actually, that doesn't work at all, you know, because of this or that or the other thing. It's very hard mm-hmm. for both the users and developers to really fully understand the consequences of what you're going to be building and what kind of problems it will be mm-hmm. solving. So,
So we've made good experience with paper prototypes and with early things that give users some idea of what it is that we think we should be building, and they can tell us, well, that is a stupid idea. I can't use it like that. And it helps a lot if you do that before you start, you know, even building that first implementation that they can actually use. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've experienced as well? Is that something that you've used this approach?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely, just anything you can do to get feedback. But I think mm-hmm. also that very often that I see that people use that kind of approach to kind of keep the developers at bay, you know, that there's, we'll use some paper prototypes, you know, we'll do user testing with our, you know, our mock-ups and whatever. And therefore you, the developers, don't need to be involved with the users at all, because we have, you know, so mm-hmm. That's an issue that I see a lot, that, you know, I think it's fantastic to, you know, use mock-ups and whatever, but the amount of issues that arise once you start trying to actually write code to support the paper mock-ups, you know, it's essential that you really, you know, get to those as quickly as possible. Because I mean, there are, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many things that can go wrong and so many things that you don't think of that only appear once you actually try to code it.
Yeah.
You know, then you're
completely
like,
agreed. Yes. Yes. I think maybe the value in those prototypes is to figure out what you shouldn't be building more than what you should be. Right. I mean, you've tried this and this fails even at this level. Right. I mean, they see for the first time they can imagine that this is what it would be like, and they tell you, well, that is not something that I need, right? I need something completely different. That's a very valuable information, right?
Absolutely.
But I completely agree that you have to actually, you know, I mean, even for a developer, even if you pride yourself in your mental skills and all of your knowledge of computer systems, you figure out things once you actually build stuff, right? Once you have to build it completely, you figure out, well, I have never thought about this particular corner case, what do I do here? And then it helps the developers as much as it helps the users to actually build things and get feedback from them. Yeah. Completely agree with that. Yes.
And I also think that it makes sense to have, you know, developers involved, even if they're not making the prototypes, but at least keep them in the loop, because so much time is wasted often by, you know, developers coming up with ideas that have already been tested, you know, and then you end up discussing things over and over and over and over again. This is process wise, it makes sense to have everyone involved as much as possible, even though developers aren't part of the, you know, early prototyping stages. Just having some technical people involved early on makes a lot of sense, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one other thing that you've mentioned before, and I think you have sort of a little, you have a problem with that word, is the word platform, right? And this idea of having those big things that solve everything. Can you talk a little bit more about why you think it's a bad idea to build those big platform projects?
Yeah, well, firstly, again, you know, when you're going to be building software, I think it's essential that you step back and think, well, what am I actually trying to do? Who am I actually trying to help? You know, the only reason we build software is to help users do something, you know, and I have never heard an end user, you know, say like a nurse in a nursing home, they've never said, oh man, I just wish I had a platform. You know, the end users, they don't need a
with
platform.
With a microservices architecture.
They don't need these things, you know? So we need to focus on what people are actually building. And if what you end up building turns into a platform, then that's fine. You know, but the point is, you have to, I think it's very natural for people, you know, if you are in charge of, you know, a whole, you know, portfolio, lots of different applications, you have this, if you're selling software or you're buying software or whatever, if you're in charge of lots of stuff, it's very natural for you to think, oh man, wouldn't it be easy if I just had a platform where all of this stuff fit nicely in? But you have to consciously and always try to get out of the mindset of what's comfortable for you and to focus on what's comfortable for what's useful for the end users. And the end users, they don't need that platform, you know, so that's kind of, so I don't necessarily have anything against platforms. It's just that should not be your end goal. And even Apple, when they set up, when, you know, they have a, you know, huge platform now, right? With the App Store and all this kind of stuff. But they didn't start off making, you know, like a platform. When they started making the iPhone, you know, I heard a podcast where they're talking about the process, and their main focus was, we need to build a phone that works, you know, that has the necessary enough functionality for people to actually have a working telephone device, which with some cool extra features. You know, and then the platform kind of grew from that, you know, and that's how you build platforms. So, again, you know, what I've been arguing a lot with, when it comes to, you know, public, healthcare systems is, you know, even as a developer, you know, you don't necessarily need things to be in a platform. What you need is for various parts to have good APIs. You need to make systems that you can, you know, the services that have APIs that you can call. And if you take the project I'm working on right now, we're building a platform, you could call it, I suppose, but it's a web application so far. No, but it's a kind of a web shop, but it's for a local kind of niche stores that don't have the resources themselves to have a web shop and to put all the effort. So we have this kind of common thing, so people can get their goods delivered, same day delivery to the local area. So it's basically kind of, you know, a platform for local stores to put their wares. And of course, for there, we're integrated with Stripe for payment, and we have to send emails and we have to send SMSs. So we are integrating with lots of different services, but none of those things are on the same platform, you know? And I think there's lots of people, especially like business people who are buying software, they think that in order for things to work together, it has to be on the same platform. And that's just not true. And I mean, even if we had a platform that had payment solutions and email services and SMS services, even if that were on the same platform, there would still be different API calls, right? You know, sending an email is not the same thing as sending money to someone, you know? So, I mean, even if, you know,
from the ivory tower, it looks very similar to me.
There are too many people who are way too far removed from the actual coding aspect for making decisions. And they think that they're helping people, you know, people like me who are, you know, writing the code. They think they're helping me by building these platforms when I don't even need them. You know, who needs them? The user doesn't need them. I don't need them. I mean, like, if they evolve naturally, then fine, you know, but again, we have to make sure that there's an actual need for it.
But it sounds a bit as if it's always management's fault. Is it always management's fault? Isn't it also something? okay, done. Thank you. No, isn't it also sometimes developers or architects who overcomplicate things and create huge disaster in terms of size and complexity?
Definitely, of course, yes. No, I mean, I think this is a human issue. You know, we see things from our perspective. You know, and me as a developer, and I keep catching myself doing this all the time, you know, that I'm like, the user says something completely sensible that they want, and I'm like, no, because that's going to ruin my code, you know, and we have our own perspective on things. We go to a conference and we learn about this new kind of technology we want to try out. We have these kind of technological visions about how cool it would be if all the systems work together in this or that way. So yeah, definitely, this is not a management issue at all. And I think that everyone involved in building software needs to actively, it's like on a daily basis, just slap themselves in the face and go like, oi, it's not about you. You know, it's about the user. You know, what do the users actually need? You know, it's not about the beautiful code or the wonderful architectural diagrams or the prestigious big projects. It's about why are we doing this? You know, that should be the purpose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What role does size play? How important and what kind of effect does, the availability of resources, and maybe it's not even size, you know, the resources in terms of people, I shouldn't be using resources to talk about human beings, but you know what I mean, right? We're in the enterprising world after all, right? So what's the effect of resources, whether they're human or financial or whatever, on projects?
Well, I think in every dimension, it's super important that we kind of cut back. You know, you should never, you know, the project that I've been ranting about on Twitter a lot, you know, this healthcare project, they've said, we have 10 years and we're going to spend 22 billion NOK. And this is a complete disaster from the outset. You know, if you should never, if I give you 10 billion euros, you know, you're going to be thinking, oh, how do I spend the 10 billion? You know, you're going to spend those 10 billion euros and then come back and ask for more. If I give you 10,000, you know, you're going to have to try to be a bit more clever and focus and prioritize, you know, so we really, you know, for all sorts of reasons, it's super important that we do not just, you know, go ahead with these, we start off with these like 10 years and umpteen billion. You have to limit, if you limit time, limit the budget, and also, again, limit the number of people. You know, people, the more people are involved, the harder it's going to be to work, you know, listen to me. I'm chattering on. I have lots of ideas. You know, just the more people like me you have to deal with on a daily basis, you're not going to get anything done. People are just going to be arguing and talking and trying to figure out what to do instead of just working effectively. So, I mean, it's super important to cut down size in every possible aspect as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. So what kinds of ways have you seen being successful in coordinating the work across multiple teams? So my idea would be that if you have this huge thing, then you could do it with 500 people, or you could decide not to do that, cut it back from 500 to maybe 100. But the 100 is still way too much for a team, right? Because a good team size is what? I don't know, 7, 8, 10 people, something like that. Let's just assume that somebody has allocated way too much budget, like those 10 billion euros or dollars or whatever. They've given the project 10 years, which is way too much time, and they've assigned 500 people, which is way too many people. So we cut it back, but we can't cut it back to just 10 people and half a year because it's too complex for that. I mean, it's not a simple thing. It is a complex thing. Maybe it's a healthcare system, which is hugely complex. It's something to do with tax law or, you know, some complicated life insurance, whatever thing. It doesn't matter. Something complicated that has lots of actual complexity, not accidental, not homegrown complexity, but actual business domain complexity. So let's assume we can cut it down from 500 people to 100 people, and from 10 years to 2 years. Then we're going to have those 100 people not in one team, but in many teams. How do you coordinate them without doing something that, again, becomes way too enterprisey and complicated to get stuff done?
I think this is, obviously not, it's not a trivial thing. But again, if you focus on the end user, I think it's it doesn't have to be that hard, because I mean the software that you are that you're building, it's going to have to kind of help someone do something. you know, and there's just no user that has needs for a software system that requires, you know, billions, you know, it should, if you look at what a single person actually has to do and tasks that they have to perform, I think, it is normally not that hard to find divisions of labor that can kind of focus on actual needs, you know, and if you think about this, you know, the things that have been massively successful when it comes to, you know, software systems, they're always the smaller ones, you know, like email, you know, sending email is super, you know, it's super simple and limited, you know, it's like a to and a from and a text and a attachments, you know, it's because there's lots more complexity involved, of course, but because it's so limited, it is also way more useful to far more people, you know, and this is just, you know, you need to just break it down into things that people actually need and not worry so much about, like, you know, my email client looks nothing like my IDE for writing software, you know, but that's okay. You know, we need to stop worrying about users having different colored buttons or, you know, so we need to find ways limiting collaboration between teams, basically. Just try to say, like, how can we avoid that these people have to talk to each other? How can we let them work in peace and really develop something that is useful on its own? You know, like, again, sending messages here or there of a specific type, you know, or, you know, doing some concrete thing. And, you know, and in my experience, it's not necessarily that hard to find, you know, reasonably sensible divisions of labor when you look at what the actual needs of the actual users are. It's only when you look at things from the developer's perspective, you know, like the person who's responsible for the technological platform, or if you look at it from the management's perspective, where it's like, oh, I'm in charge of all, you know, everyone working at the council level or, you know, something like that. That's when it becomes complicated. If you look at who's actually going to be using what, you know, then finding sensible divisions of labor is perfectly sensible. And again, the clue here is we need to find ways of dividing things so that the teams don't have to collaborate all the time. You know, you have to have, you know, loosely coupled and highly cohesive team units, you know, that they can deliver functionality without having to coordinate with everyone else. I shouldn't have to ask like three other teams, can I release this now? You know, I should be able to work effectively and deliver value without having to, you know, coordinate with everyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I completely agree. In fact, we've been advocating something quite close to that, right? We've been advocating that each of those teams gets release responsibility for a system or a set of systems and doesn't have to collaborate on the same system with other teams, because that, of course, means they have to coordinate all the time and figure out a way to solve both sets of problems in the same system as opposed to having two. So this idea of accepting a certain degree of redundancy, you know, redundant code, redundant data, whatever, with the goal of increasing autonomy, right, is something that I think many people have discovered independently sort of at the same time, because this fact that things don't move fast if you don't do that has become obvious to many people. So I agree with that. I was wondering while you were explaining this, that maybe I don't know whether we could turn this into some diagram, some typical consultant diagram or a law or something. But it seems to me that if you want to become more generic, then the cost of that is increases maybe with the square of the increase of genericity that want to do that. So for example, you could build a text processing program. Like, you could build a competitor to Microsoft Word. I don't think you can build a competitor to Word in 6 months with three people. I mean, there's tons of stuff in there, or maybe Excel or whatever, right? Or a browser or something like that. It's a huge amount of knowledge and technical expertise and stuff that went into each of those things, because there's hugely complex things. And they are very, very widely usable. Almost everybody has a use for one of those things, right? I can use a spreadsheet for basically all 90% of the things that I do with a computer, I could do with a spreadsheet. So it's a very generic piece of thing, but it also cost a shit ton of money. It was an incredible investment to do that. And most organizations don't have that kind of money, or don't want to throw that kind of money at anything. It doesn't make any sense, because they're not building a software product for a few hundred million people. They're building something that's being used by, I don't know, maybe 10% of the citizens of this country, that is still not the same thing as text processor or something like that, that would be used by hundreds of millions of people. Right?
Absolutely. And also, I mean, I think it's also important to realize, like, how long has Microsoft been working on Excel and Word?
Exactly.
You know, they've been working on this for ages, you know? So, I mean, there's so much work has gone into that. And I think also we need to, as developers, we need to leverage Excel to a far higher degree. That's one of the things that I think can really, really give enormous cost savings and in lots of projects, is if we just say, you know what, we're going to make a system that solves 90% of your most common problems, you know, 90% we can automate, even, you know, we can make this super simple. But then the remaining 10% that are a bit complicated, if we don't have to pull that complexity into what we're making for you, you can still use Excel to solve, you know, to solve those things. And I think that's at least as a really good technique to at least, you know, to start off. You know, you don't have to wait until every possible feature that anyone has imagined is in place. You know, you can start off by solving the most common thing, and then let people, if they're already using Excel, you can at least, you know, take that in steps. So, you know, first delivery, you'd still be using Excel for some stuff. The next delivery, okay, even more stuff would be taken out of Excel. But I mean, maybe some things, you know, don't, if that's what they've been using to organize their work, well, maybe we should, you know, at least have that as an option for, you know, not say, if they need to do some weird and wonderful thing once every 5 years in Excel, then that's not the end of the world, you know, and dragging, instead of spending billions, dragging that into an already complex
platform.
System. Huh? Yeah, you know, I know, but I mean, there's
should
so
be
much
part of the platform, right?
But there's so many.
Every decent platform should have a bad re-implementation of half of Excel. That's sort of. Okay. So, I agree. I mean, maybe sometimes we should be, and I think a colleague of mine wrote an article about that. I can link to that. Sometimes we should, as developers or architects or, you know, technical people helping decision makers make good technical decisions, we should be the ones maybe arguing for not building software at all.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
Many times it's a very bad idea. Don't do that, right? Yes. It's not a good candidate.
Use a Google form, you know?
yes, exactly. Or, you know, that sounds like a Trello board to me.
Yeah, exactly.
If you ask me, that's a Trello board.
Yeah.
Or a WordPress installation.
Absolutely. Or sticky notes, you know? Just don't,
sticky
you know,
notes. Yeah,
there
yeah.
are it's so like many pen, things pen you do not need software for.
Yeah, completely agree. Okay, so maybe one of the, I mean, while we're renting, I don't think we've talked enough about vendors. What role do vendors play in this whole thing?
Yes. No, I mean, this is a big problem, of course, because, I mean, you have all these large, like SAP and whatever organizations who have found out that they can't, you know, they can't possibly know the domain of all the various companies in the world. So they start thinking, well, what can I sell? I need to make something that I can sell no matter what their actual problems are, you know? And basically, so they sell just glorified programming languages, basically. So that, I mean, it's basically this own system where you can kind of configure and make your own software within the platform, you know? So it's like super configurable. I don't know what to do, what we can do with them. But I mean, it's just from a technical point of view, it's so obvious that what they're, you know, to get them to work, you need an enormous amount of customization to make it fit the domain it's for, right? And I think people just don't realize that customizing software and writing software are very much the same. It's a similar kind of thing. You know, it's like, if you're going to be customizing it anyway, you might as well use the best tools for software customization, which is actually code. Like, writing code is far more effective than, you know, doing the same thing within a platform. I don't know.
Yeah. I think, I mean, we've probably all seen those projects where the customization of a piece of standard software was more expensive than we could ever imagine a complete customer-specific bespoke custom solution would have been, right? If the, I don't know, the customization project cost 100 million euros, and say, well, I can build the whole thing for 10.
Yeah.
Then of course that might be, you know, just developer arrogance, because like not invented here feelings. Yeah. Like, I mean, I could do, I mean, how could they possibly spend this amount of money? I could do it for a tenth of that. Yeah. Every developer or lots of developers will think that way. Maybe not everyone, but lots of them. Hmm. So that could be one part of it. Another factor, I think, is the risk part of things, right? That people think it's less risky to go with the standard software.
Yeah, but and this is
which
the thing.
I don't think to, is
because it's not standard software. I think this is the thing with those platforms. That it, you know, I'm all for buying standard software. Stuff you can mm-hmm. use off the shelf is fantastic. Anytime you can use something off the shelf, go for it. You should definitely mm-hmm. use off the shelf where you can. But if you are going to, if you have to spend millions customizing it, then that is not a software. That is not an off the shelf product. You know, you need to just realize that you're not getting off the shelf. You're just buying a very ineffective way of customizing software. It's the most ineffective way of writing software ever. So yeah, we need to somehow, I don't think I'm the right person to convince, you know, management people about this, but somehow we need to get the word out that this is a con, you know, it's a complete con for so many mm-hmm. people.
Yeah, so probably there's sort of a breaking point, right? At a certain level of customization. I mean, obviously a little bit of customization is fine because you'll have to customize everything, right? But there is a certain point where it turns into actual custom development.
Yeah.
Where, as you say, you get all of the problems associated with that, like, you know, problems with updates and inefficient development tools. And, you know, you can't find people who know this stuff. And you specifically can't find good people who want to know this stuff because the good people don't want to do that kind of work.
And you can't upgrade to the latest version because your customizations aren't compatible with a new version.
So all of those things happen, but they happen after a certain point in time. And it's always hard to, you know, in the beginning, find out whether you're in that range or not, right? Because every time you have and I've been to many of those vendor meetings for our clients. I've also been involved in making those decisions, sometimes for ourselves, for our own company, right? You have to make the decision while you're still completely ignorant of what it is that you need and how well that is actually being handled by that piece of software, because the vendor only has one answer, that is yes, of course it can do that, sure, no problem, everybody does that. And then you start the project, and those projects are very hard to do in an agile fashion, right? I mean, you don't typically do a customization project in small increments, like where you get user feedback after a few weeks. That's not how they happen. They typically happen with a lot of planning, with a lot of, like you say, the construction work, the construction site work, right? The classical project management is a very good match for those kinds of projects. Yeah. And you spend a lot of time thinking of what it is and gathering requirements and then spending all the customization thing. And then you run into that sunk cost fallacy because, after all, you've now spent 2 years customizing the damn thing. So it should better give you some return on investment. Otherwise, you look really bad. So I think there are not many people who actually love their customized standard software.
Heard of very few. Okay. And I think the ones I have heard of have been the managers who ordered it in the first place, and they have every incentive to make it sound great. But and user-wise too, it's a complete disaster typically.
Yeah, so maybe we can postulate that if end users are happy with standard software, then it's always the kind of standard software that hasn't been customized. So we could test that. Maybe our listeners can give us some feedback on that. Mm-hmm. I would claim there is awesome standard software mm-hmm. that many people like and love, and they would much prefer it to whatever custom solution their company has, because many individual software solutions, many custom software solutions suck and have a horrible UI and are, you know, they look as if they have been built 20 years ago because they have been built 20 years ago. And you'd much rather be using whatever Google provides or Apple provides or Microsoft provides, because it's much nicer and modern and fast and it looks as if it could do the same thing. But I haven't yet heard anybody say that of one of those enterprise resource planning systems or, you know, supply chain management systems that took 2 years to customize before they... Nobody has ever told me that those have sexy UIs and that they liked using it and preferred to custom solutions. I'm sure about that. So I want to ask you one other question, which I think is possibly might lead to criticism of everything that we do, which is how sure are we that people's lives actually are improved by software? I'm not even saying that people, you know, are involved in the decision-making process about the user interfaces and the way to do things. I'm questioning, even if it's like, you know, if it's usable and pretty and has a good user experience and stuff like that, How often are people actually asked whether their life or their job has improved after this software has been introduced?
Yeah, no, that, I think this is so important. You know, like I just saw Microsoft are now rolling out this like surveillance tool thing as part of their Office 365 thing.
I think they've just apologized a few hours ago, so this might be old news once this airs, but I don't know.
Okay, thank goodness.
You're talking about. So
but maybe, you know, that
maybe
kind
you
of
should
thing.
Explain it to the listeners, right?
Yeah,
maybe some have not caught on the debate.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just basically, you know, the part of their Office 365 pack kind of just tells you, you know, rates you, gives you a score for like how productive you are and, you know, how good you are interacting with your colleagues and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's so much software that's being built. That is just, you know, from, you know, this is obviously like surveillance stuff, which is problematic. Mm-hmm. But there's so many things that we build that just make people's lives worse, like notifications, you know, that are always like, hey, come look at your phone now, keep, you know, paying attention, buy more crap, you know, like tailored, customized advertising. You know, so much of the stuff we build is, yeah, making people's lives way worse. You know, we're selling products. I mean, the smartest people are being headhunted into, you know, marketing and financial stuff that, you know, most, you know, very often are not making the world a better place at all. And I really wish that we'd focus more on, you know, why are we even building this? Does this actually, you know, are we solving a real problem or are we making that problem worse just so some people make money? You know, and I really wish that more people would say no to taking part in projects that are obviously have negative social value.
Mm-hmm. I think it's not an easy decision, but it's kind of, you know, an obvious problem if you have ethical doubts about the kind of project that you're doing, right? Like, I don't know, maybe you're not a big fan of the military and you're being asked to, you know, write software for some killer drone or something. That's kind of, you know, not easy. Maybe it's not obvious for everyone, would be kind of obvious for me, but people have different opinions on those things. And I think that's one part. Another part that I found interesting is that sometimes you automate things, and when you automate them, you very often automate the business process as people want it to be. Specifically, not only managers, I don't want to blame the managers again, right? But the people responsible for defining how stuff works mandate this particular process be implemented in a software, right?
Yeah.
Well, in actual real life, things might be done differently. Like in a doctor's office, the doctor's assistant might be doing some sort of work that she's not really allowed to do, right? She's maybe, you know, handing out recipes to patients who come in every week because she knows it's perfectly fine. This person gets it every week. You won't codify that. You won't make that part of a piece of software because that would violate a rule. But because you have now implemented the rule, you don't leave room for exceptions, right? You don't give people the opportunity to do things differently than what's in the rule book. And everybody has always worked around the rule books, right? Everybody has always done stuff that was not allowed, not strictly, but still somehow okay. Mm. And that's kind of a problem because our systems don't typically have that option. And if there's a rule that says, well, this has to be signed off by an actual doctor, can't be signed off by an assistant or a nurse or whatever, then as a developer, you would actually be doing something wrong if you implemented it differently, right? You have to implement it in the way that the law says it needs to be done, even though that doesn't actually help anybody, right? Because the poor person won't get their recipe this week, even though they need it, because it's really complicated.
Absolutely. I think, you know, that's another thing that I think we should be aware of. And that, you know, in many cases, I mean, the right thing to do is, you know, instead of preventing someone from doing something, highlighting that it might be problematic, you know, in the cases where, you know, some cases, you know, that's, we can't do that, but, you know, where possible, that should be, you know, anyway, let people do the wrong thing. Just show them, you know, say, oi. You know, flag this with a big yellow marker and say, hey, are you aware that this thing is not following the standard? You know, that might be a better thing to do rather than say, nope. You know, computer says no. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that sketch, but anyway, but this is, there's nothing worse than computer systems that actually prevent you from doing stuff because their rules might change too. You know, so that's another thing. So if you let people kind of make mistakes, and instead kind of highlight what you believe might be a mistake, then you make it more flexible in case people actually have to override and whatever. Right. So stuff like that we can do.
And, Yeah, and I'm not trying to suggest surveillance again, but with this you could actually gather some feedback as to where your rule doesn't work, right? I mean, I have implemented this wonderful automated process, but nobody ever uses it because it doesn't work for them. Why do they always take this shortcut? Why do they always do it by hand? Well, let's watch them. Let's figure it out and see. Oh, that is what we need needed to automate. Not that. That would be very helpful.
Yep.
Okay. So maybe let's move on to, I mean, we've talked so much about what's bad about those projects, right? Maybe let's talk a bit about what we could do to improve it. And of course, this will relate to what we just talked about.
Yeah.
So what's your best advice? How do we go about improving those projects for us?
Well, there's so many things. But again, we've talked about this, just cutting things up, you know, just give up on this idea and that you can have this one unified thing that solves everything, you know? So talk to the, you know, go just break things down to, you know, which users do we want to help, you know, and then set up a team, you know, like, I don't know, 5 developers, some UX people, you know, and someone, and just work with them, show them design ideas, implement stuff, just start straight away talking to them and find out how can I deliver value to these people as quickly as possible. You know, don't mm-hmm. wait, you know, don't have this like, oh, we mustn't bring, you know, I think that's another problem is people don't have developers in-house and that kind of leads to them. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's wait until we have enough to do before we, you know, actually start with a development thing. We really need to get away from that. You need to just get technical people on board straight away, along with UX and design and whatever. But just everyone just talk to the users, start, you sit next to them, sit in their offices when COVID allows us to. Anyway, just focus on end users, break people into small teams and start straight away. And again, just set time. And for business people, they're always wanting like, well, how much will this cost and how long will it take? Just set from the outset. This is our budget for a limited time. You know, limited budgets, limited time, because that focuses you. Because then you are thinking of, okay, well, what can I do within the next 6 months? Or what can I even do within the next, you know, 3 months? Or just, you know, limit stuff to smaller units makes so much sense in every possible dimension. And we really need to, and this sounds like such a no-brainer. I feel like an idiot, you know, because like, why do I even have to say that? You know, and this is what, again, from what I mentioned already, this is of course how I worked when I first started for startups, because this is the natural and intuitive way of thinking about these things. So it's kind of, you know, sad that for some reason, once things go professional, you know, then people go away from what is intuitively right from the outset. So,
So let me follow up on one thing that you said. We're both working for consultancies, right? So we both, our companies, we ourselves make money working for projects like that, right? But you mentioned that people should have their own developers. And in fact, I strongly agree. So I would claim that the number one thing that I would advise, if I had anything to say, the public sector should do is to get in-house expertise, find a way to pay developers actual competitive salaries and get some actual technical, expertise in-house to make better decisions. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I think that's having your own people in-house that know what they're talking about. Not least just so you're capable of hiring the right people, you know, just knowing exactly who you should get, you know, because I mean, finding the right contractors to help you is going to be a lot easier if you already have some kind of technical expertise, you know what to look for. Definitely. And again, this should make sense to everyone. If what you are building, if your service depends on computer systems in any way, shape or form, then writing software is part of your core competency as a company, and not having the capacity to make your own product, you know, that's crazy, you know? And especially in the public sector, you know, there's not going to be a marketplace for implementations of the Norwegian tax code. You know, there's not going to be a marketplace where they can buy Norwegian tax regulation stuff. This has to be made by the Norwegian public sector, has to own this, and we have to have, you know, so that's a no-brainer. But actually the project I'm on right now, there are no in-house developers on at all. And we are, we're like 9 people now. So, I mean, it is possible to have, to get people in, but again, we're like 10 people in total. That is the entirety of the project, you know? So I think it's, you know, getting people, hiring in people, if you don't have them on board, that's fine too, but just don't let them take over completely. You know, you don't want to hire a consultancy and then have them show up on day one with like 10 scrum teams of 7 people in each. And, you know, so as long as you can have maintained control of the process, it's, you know, perfectly fine to get in external people, but yeah, have, you know, control the, what you are, what you're making and mm-hmm. have some idea of, you know, where you should be going with it.
So in Germany, the public sector has managed to create a market by building the same thing many, many, many times, right? Okay. So the federal state, and they know the decentralization leads to the fact that everybody makes their own decisions. So everybody hires somebody else to deliver a crappy system. So we've got tons of crappy systems. Whatever, I shouldn't be ranting about that particular aspect. But again, I think we agree that, and that's, as you said, it's a general rule, right? For, no matter what the organization does, it's not restricted to the public sector. It's restricted to any organization that does anything that depends on software, which basically is almost everyone. Yes. So almost every company, every organization needs this in-house competency, even though we kind of make money because people don't have it. We're, I guess we would be making money even if they had that capacity. I think some contractors, some companies, some consultancies who sort of depend on their lack of knowledge would maybe have a problem, but we don't have to worry about that. So that's fine. Okay. Enough of the self-aggrandization. So what about the other vendor aspect? What about the platform vendors and commercial off-the-shelf software vendors?
Yeah, well, like here again, you know, I guess just if you have your own in-house people who know what development means and what you can, what if they know what's possible to build, you know, actual software development, and once you know what the, you know, what these platforms can, you know, can deliver, you know, then, you know, I'd feel much safer and that they would take, rational choices. Then the problem now, the reason these vendors are able to sell in these systems is because they're selling it to people who have no idea what the alternatives really are. You know, they just don't know because there's no, you know, what I'm selling is basically just don't buy the platform, you know, and that's not a product, you know? So you have someone who sells everything and then you have people who say, no, don't buy everything, you know? And of course, buying from the guy who says, I can give you everything you want in one platform. That sounds a lot better. So we just, but I guess just education and again, having people internally who understand this would be, you know, that I think that's the only antidote really.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think this was an awesome conversation. I think we've hit on most of the things that we wanted to talk about. So for some final notes, do you have some resources that you would like to point people to? What are good things to read or check out if people want to find more help or find more rents?
So, well, I've just finished Seeing Like a State, which is an amazing book that I think everyone should read. And there's nothing about software there. And it just shows how we as human beings have trouble. Again, you know, the title of the book, Seeing Like a State, is like how we struggle trying to implement these huge, you know, projects that do too much at once, you know, and it goes through everything from like scientific forestry in, I think, Germany in the late 1800s, mm-hmm. where they decided that, oh, we want, you know, organized forests with just spruce trees that are spaced just so and have no other plants around because we don't want any mess. And they're very organized, nice rows of trees. And this worked brilliantly for 20 years. And then the whole forest died, you know, of course, because you need that underlying complexity and all the, things aren't that simple, you know, and there's, you know, just tons of really interesting examples from all over the place. You know, you have communism, you have forced resettlement schemes in Africa. It's a really interesting book about how human beings try and fail again and again in every possible domain when we try to do too much at once. So a super interesting book, Seeing Like a State. But for more software technical stuff, I recommend Accelerate, which is just a book about like how looking at actual companies out there and, you know, measuring how good quality, you know, the quality they're delivering, how fast are they able to work, You know, these are real like facts about what works and what does not work about software. And they, and yeah, it's a very interesting book, and it just shows how to organize things and what, yeah, how to work effectively.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would add one myself, if I may, which is the whole work of the British government digital service, which I really like. They've got lots of excellent resources about how they improved government IT. And they, I think some of the stuff that they wrote, some of the pages that they have published, some of the open source software that they did and the open source guides are just fantastic. I read them and I have a similar feeling that I sometimes have when I listen to your talks, which is, finally somebody says it, right? So that is the, that's a good thing. It's, they improved. They actually did quite a few things that are kind of similar to what we discussed. Mm. So we'll put that in the show notes as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I wholeheartedly support that. There's some wonderful reading material and depressing reading material if you happen to be living in a country that does not have sensible guidelines like they do.
Okay. So, Christine, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for being on the show. For our listeners, I think it was a very interesting episode. I know it was for me. Thank you very much and have a good day.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye.